Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the most dangerous man in America. That's how Henry Kissinger described whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, who famously leaked a top-secret study of the Vietnam War in 1971 to the New York Times and other news outlets. The publication resulted in a landmark Supreme Court decision on freedom of the press, increased pressure to end the Vietnam War, and was a key factor in the resignation of Richard Nixon. A new film tells that story, and this week on a special edition of Counterspin, we'll talk to Daniel Ellsberg and Rick Goldsmith, co-director of the new film, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
It is difficult to overstate President Obama's unpopularity in most of Louisiana. That's what Campbell Robertson wrote in the New York Times on September 11th, yet somehow Robertson managed to pull it off. The main piece of evidence that Robertson presented for Obama's unpopularity in the state is that he only got 14% of the white vote in 2008. And Robertson pointed out that Louisiana is two-thirds white. What Robertson doesn't point out is that Obama did extremely well among voters who aren't white. So he ended up with 40% of the vote. Not a great showing, but it's better than Obama did in about a half a dozen other states. By focusing on the white vote and ignoring the overall vote, Robertson gives the impression that he thinks white opinion is what really matters, kind of like the way MSNBC's Chris Matthews used to do when he would contrast the African-American community with what he called regular people. And of course, focusing on whites alone can lead you astray if you're trying to read the political situation. As evidence that Obama is a political liability in Louisiana, Robertson cites a state Senate race where the Republican candidate mailed out an ad featuring an image of a hippie and the text, "You might be a liberal if you voted for Barack Obama." Robertson does mention that this Republican ended up losing the election, but he still treats that anecdote as an illustration of what he calls Louisiana's increasingly reddish hue. This New York Times story seemed to be following the old journalistic advice, don't let the facts get in the way of a good story.
Media critics often call for journalists to not just parrot official statements, but check them against reality and call out any falsehoods. Then again, sometimes journalists check official statements in such a way that you'd like to call for them to please stop. A recent example came from the September 13th New York Times, where Cheryl Gay Stolberg wrote a piece about one of Barack Obama's health care speeches. Obama cited a report from the Treasury Department that readers were told he said found that nearly half of all Americans under 65 will lose their health coverage at some point over the next 10 years, and that more than one-third will go without coverage for longer than 1 year. But aha, writes Stolberg, quote, "In fact, that is not precisely what the department found when it analyzed data from a University of Michigan survey that tracked the health insurance status of more than 17,000 Americans from 1997 to 2006. The survey found that 47.7% had lost coverage at some point during those 10 years for 1 month or more, and that 36% lacked coverage for at least 1 year during that time, though not necessarily 12 months consecutively. Mr. Obama extrapolated those statistics to predict what might happen in the future. Critics say that the president, who has deplored the scare tactics of his opponents, is now employing scare tactics of his own." Close quote. Well, in case you didn't follow that or think you didn't, the concern is that Obama's presentation is importantly misleading because the immediate future could, for reasons unexplained, be radically different from the recent past. Or as Dean Baker put it, Obama was making extrapolations about the future based on the past. Next thing, he'll be telling us that black is white and night is day. This is why we need an independent media.
On September 11th, Michigan abortion protester James Pouliot was killed as he stood across the street from a high school, holding a sign that included a graphic image of an aborted fetus. For some in the media, this killing could be placed alongside the high-profile murder in June of George Tiller, a doctor who performed some rare late-term abortions. Tiller was a frequent and high-profile target of anti-choice activists and had survived several assassination attempts. As ABC's Chris Bury put it on the World News broadcast on the 11th, quote, quote, "Today's Michigan killing represents the flip side of the troubling violence surrounding the abortion debate," close quote. After quoting an anti-choice activist demanding that authorities treat this crime as seriously as the Tiller murder, Bury concluded, quote, "George Tiller and Jim Pulliam, on opposite sides of the abortion divide, both victims of the hate that too often surrounds it," close quote. But this comparison is way off the mark. Tiller was the subject of a long campaign by pro-life activists, with national TV personalities like Bill O'Reilly denouncing him as a baby killer. Tiller's murderer was well known among anti-abortion extremists. The Pulliam case has little comparable backstory. The shooter is also charged with another unrelated murder the same day, and there was no campaign to specifically target Pulliam for anything. The desire to see this killing as evidence of violence on both sides does a disservice to those who work for reproductive rights in the face of serious threats to their lives and to those around them.
The release of a UN investigation into the Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip brought pretty typical media coverage. The headline stressed that both Israelis and Palestinians were found to have committed possible war crimes, and Israeli officials were cited denouncing the report as unfair. A September 15th PBS NewsHour report illustrated the approach. Gwen Ifill interviewed the lead UN investigator, Richard Goldstone, at one point asking him, quote, "Your criticism of Israel seems so much harsher than that of the Palestinians. Why is that?" Close quote. It's a strange question to imagine asking, given the lopsided body count of the war itself. During the late 2008, early 2009 military operation, 4 Israeli civilians were killed by rockets fired from Gaza, along with 9 soldiers. 1,400 Palestinians were killed, over half of those civilians. So a fact-finding report that failed to reflect that reality would be unusual, if not meaningless. But sometimes in the media, being even-handed is a more important goal than being accurate. So it was no surprise that Ifill's next guest was the Israeli ambassador to the United States, who predictably denounced the UN. In the corporate media, that's balance.
And finally, some in the media are wondering if corporate journalists aren't paying enough attention to conservative activism. After weeks of obsessive and misleading commentary, Fox News host Glenn Beck stirred up so much of a ruckus about White House green jobs advisor Van Jones that he resigned his post. Next came the so-called 9/12 protests in Washington, inspired to some degree by Beck, where right-wing protesters aired their grievances against the Obama White House. That is, when they weren't questioning his birth certificate or comparing him to a Nazi. Next in line, right-wing activists shot undercover video of visits to local offices of ACORN, the National Community Organizing Group, where some staffers apparently gave genuine legal advice to a couple who claimed to be running a prostitution ring that, in one case, involved underage girls. The question on the table, then, have the liberal media ignored these newsworthy events? In the Jones case, Washington Post reporter Howard Kurtz chastised the press for missing the boat. But because something is an obsession of Glenn Beck's doesn't make it news. Jones was a staffer at the Council on Environmental Quality, not exactly a high-profile government agency. And under the Bush administration, a staffer in that same agency was forced out when it was revealed that he was editing climate change reports to make them more industry-friendly. While that scandal involved someone's actual government work, it got only scattered media attention. We don't recall folks like Howard Kurtz complaining about the media blackout. The Politico raised some of these same questions about whether the mainstream media were missing out on these important right-wing scoops. But they're asking the wrong question. These stories are of minor importance and have actually received major attention in the media. So the question really shouldn't be why the mainstream media missed them. Rather, the question should be why the petty obsessions of right-wing pundits have to be big news at all.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. In 1971, Daniel Ellsberg became one of the most important whistleblowers in U.S. history. A former strategist at the Rand Corporation, Ellsberg leaked a secret report about the Vietnam War, later known as the Pentagon Papers, to several U.S. news outlets. The papers revealed the U.S. government's profound cynicism towards the public and disregard for the deaths and injuries suffered by soldiers and civilians. Criminal actions taken by the Nixon White House against Ellsberg following the paper's publication in the New York Times and elsewhere, contributed to the eventual downfall of that administration. And the story has become iconic in U.S. journalism. But what does that story have to tell us about government secrecy and the role of whistleblowers and reporters today? Have we really absorbed its lessons? A new film explores this important and relevant history. It's called The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. We are joined now in studio by Daniel Ellsberg, also author of Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers, and by independent documentary filmmaker Rick Goldsmith, whose previous films include Tell the Truth and Run, George Seldes and the American Press, nominated for an Academy Award, and Everyday Heroes, and who is co-producer and co-director with Judith Ehrlich of this new film, The Most Dangerous Man in America. Welcome, both of you, to Counterspin.
Good to be here.
Thanks.
Well, Rick, let's start with you. Documentary filmmakers often have an eye on the present and an eye on the past. Your work has explored issues of conviction and of risk, but what drove you to tell this story now?
Well, Judy and I got together in 2004, 2005, and we were embroiled then in a war, actually two wars, that we were lied into. And the parallels between what happened during the Pentagon Papers and when Daniel Ellsberg leaked them and the present day were unmistakable. And we also had a media that seemed to be more and more timid, less and less aggressive at pursuing the story in 2005 than they were, say, 30 years earlier. So we decided to go ahead. And as you mentioned, both of us, Judy and I, were concerned about stories of risk and conscience. She did a film called The Good War and Those Who Refused to Fight It, which was about conscientious objectors in World War II. And I had done a film on George Seldes, who was a muckraking journalist who really went up against the establishment at considerable risk to himself. And so really Daniel's story was an extension of that on a personal level. But it also delved into the political issues of the day, the most important political issues of the day. And we felt it was a story that was compelling and would resonate with the public. And we recognized that anybody under 50 either had no recollection of the Pentagon Papers or might know it very briefly through school, but probably had no real understanding of it and maybe not very much of an understanding of the Vietnam War and the times. So all those things put together felt like this was really time to address this story and these issues.
Dan, part of this film is about that personal transformation almost of your own, and you get the sense that without that conversion, history would have turned out very differently. But once you decided to risk your career and your life, in a sense, your attempts to hand the Pentagon Papers off to politicians didn't seem to get you much of anywhere. Is that why you went to the press? Tell us about how that came about.
That is why I went to the press. That was a mistake on my part in a way because I should have done that right from the beginning. But it seemed to me that congressional hearings were called for on this in part because the Pentagon Papers don't entirely speak for themselves or don't tell the whole story in the sense that what's written down, even in top secret form and in eyes-only memos and so forth, doesn't represent by any means the whole truth that's in the minds of the people who signed those reports. You really have to have interviews or you have to talk to these people. A lot of it doesn't get written down precisely because it might leak, and I don't mean leak to the public. It might leak to the other service or to Congress or to people who control your budget, the real enemies in some ways. So a lot of that doesn't get written down at all. I'm very aware, in other words, of the limitations of documents, even when it's as extensive as the Pentagon Papers. What I didn't realize was that Congress just wasn't going to grab that issue unless and perhaps even then, unless the public created a fire there and there was a public interest. I think Neil Sheehan, for example, was nervous as late as 1971 in the spring that I would insist on getting this material out first through Congress, and he felt that wouldn't be the most effective way to do it, and he was right about that. Now, I would have deferred to that if he'd made it clear at the point. But I, as it was, when the Pentagon Papers came out on June 13th, 71, I was still in the process of trying to encourage Senator Gravel, or before him, Pete McCloskey of the House, Senator Mathias. I'd finally given up on Senator McGovern at that point, and Senator Fulbright. My advice right now for people who feel that we're heading toward an abyss, for example, in Afghanistan, and if they know what I feel sure people do know in the Pentagon, that the 45,000 we've heard as the upper limit of what General McChrystal may ask for is by no means the ceiling on the numbers that the president has heard. That has not leaked to the public at all. No official, not even on anonymous sources, have said what I'm sure is being discussed right now in the Pentagon.
Well, let's talk more about the current landscape, because certainly for those who did not live through the history of the Vietnam War, I think they would be very struck by the press's reaction at the time. 17 papers picked up parts of the Pentagon Papers. It was featured on the evening newscasts for weeks. And I think for many people, it would be almost impossible to imagine the media system of today reacting in quite the same way to a story of that magnitude. What do you think?
Well, Nixon, of course, created what could be called a firestorm on that one for about a month by two unprecedented actions, mainly the first. It was the first injunction in our history. The First Amendment was actually written to prevent another Peter Zenger case in the colonial administration of prior restraint, of stopping a newspaper from actually printing news on the grounds that it would for any grounds, whatever. And so no one had ever tried to do that before. In fact, when Nixon on the tapes, we hear him asking John Mitchell, who wants an injunction, have we done this before? Mitchell says, oh, sure, lots of times, which shows what you get when you make your campaign manager your attorney general. He was a bond lawyer, basically. So that was an incredible error on his part. Well, by the injunction challenging the press on this, that created the story. Had I not had enough copies, which I'd made at my wife's behest, actually, to get on with it and to make enough copies so that the FBI couldn't get all my copies away from me, that gave me extra copies so that when there was one injunction after another, which actually I had not foreseen, I had extra copies to give other newspapers. So you then had an event unprecedented, I think, not only in the press, but in any institution of any country before or since. You had a wave of civil disobedience among major institutions, 19 newspapers, 17 after the Washington Post and the Times, defied the attorney general and the president, who were telling them that this wasn't just an ordinary crime. This was, they called it treason. They used the word treason, that it would damage our national security if they printed another page. And publisher after publisher, following the lead of the New York Times and the Post, which gave them a strong feeling that they were on the right track here. But they followed their own judgment and said, we don't think this will damage the national security, whatever the president says. And they defied him.
I think it's also important to look at the parallels or the contrasts between 1971 and now. In 1971, you had a press that had been kind of mistreated by a couple of administrations, as Hedrick Smith says in the film when he reads the Pentagon Papers and then sees these stories that he's been covering. He says, I remember covering that story. They were lying through their teeth when they told us that. And I think the press was poised then to jump into the fray, and the Vietnam War and the continuing new policies of what the Nixon administration was going to do in terms of sending troops into Cambodia and then to Laos and bombing and stuff like that, those were issues that were coming up every day. And the newsmen of that period in the New York Times, in the Post, in the Boston Globe and in other papers, I think they recognized that there was public policy at stake and public policy about war, which was the most critical issue of the day, and thousands of lives were at stake. And you flash forward to now, and the administrations have found ways to keep the war away from the eyes of the public. No body bags, no coffins draped with flags, embedding reporters so they're not really free to report on the war uncensored. And then you have the situation with the news staffs being cut back and cut back and cut back. And I think that the crisis of journalism today, which is our daily newspaper is going to really survive, is critical unless people see that it's issues of public policies, it's issues of war, it's issues of escalating a war of Afghanistan that are at stake.
Janine, can I add, reflecting on your question there, there's two major examples we can think of that, let's say, support the questioning tone there of how the press would behave today. The New York Times got a Pulitzer Prize for revealing that the Bush administration was clearly, blatantly violating law, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which demanded warrants for any wiretapping of American citizens. Since September 11th, essentially, they had been violating that law, which also was basically just a restating in the electronic age of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. So they were acting unconstitutionally and criminally, and they got a Pulitzer Prize for that, which they deserved. But they had had that story a year earlier, and they'd had it before the election, the second election of George W. Bush. Now, people have forgotten that was a very, very close election. And if they had published that story when the reporter felt that it was ready to go and these sub-editors agreed, this story is mature, we've got the sources, we have it, had they published that a few weeks before the election, we would have been spared 4 more years of George W. Bush. That's a pretty heavy responsibility. If they deserved a Pulitzer Prize a year later for putting out the story, what did they deserve a year earlier for not putting out the story? How about the – if there was a journalistic equivalent of impeachment, I think the editors there would have been very well ripe for that. And the fact is in the film here in Rick's and Judy's film, they quote Goodale, the counsel of the time, saying, well, how could we just ignore the First Amendment here just because we got a telegram asking us to do it? Well, in this case, the Times didn't even wait for a telegram. They had conversations with the White House. The White House said, don't do it, you know, so they didn't. And another question that occurs to me is, where were the sources who had given that story as a year went by on this crucial matter and the Times wasn't printing it? There were no other newspapers for them to go to. There is the internet. If I'd been in that position now and the Times refused to print what I gave them, which I really months went by when I did not know whether they were going to do it. Nowadays, of course, I would just go to the internet, as, by the way, I'm doing right now. I'm putting out information on the early nuclear planning that I was involved in on my website, Ellsberg.net, and on Bob Scheer's website, truthdig.com. And it just goes out. There's no time for a wire from the White House or a telephone call to get in the way. The other example worth mentioning, I think, is the attention gotten in England from the so-called Downing Street memo that showed that the White House was telling the British that they were determined to go into Iraq. And as the British intelligence chief reported to his chiefs, the intelligence was being, what was it, fixed. Intelligence being fixed to suit the policy. Now, that came out again too late after the war was in. The person who leaked that should have done so, in my opinion, 2 years earlier. But that was a report of an American meeting. How many memos of conversation are in American safes on that issue? When has there been a congressional subpoena or even a hearing asking to hear the American side of that same conversation? Nothing of that has leaked from any American source, nor has the American press probed to get it. I would say they have been falling down on the decision-making process in Washington that is manipulating us into, did manipulate us into Iraq, and is now doing so with escalation in Afghanistan, as serious as the Johnson and Nixon deceptions about the Vietnam War. We are in as much need of a Pentagon Papers now as we were then, and we haven't yet gotten it.
this might be a naive question, but we've spent a lot of time talking about how the media landscape has changed from the time you
or is the same.
Or is the same in some ways, for sure. What about inside the government? If you say there must be these documents inside the government.
Same, because we know now from memoirs of Richard Clark and others that he was one. He was the counterterrorism chief in the White House who actually presided over the meetings on 9/11 in 2001. And he has revealed in his memoirs in 2004 that he knew on September 11th and 12th that the administration intended, as he put it, to use this tragic event of 9/11 as an excuse for attacking a country, Iraq, that had nothing to do with the attack, and the attack of which would expose us to greater danger by recruiting people for al-Qaeda. He knew that, and he tells us in 2004. Had he done that 3 years earlier, he could have prevented the war, as could many, many other people. So we know that the data and that interpretation was inside the government and not only with Richard Clark. I feel certain that there are people in the Pentagon who can look at Afghanistan with the same eyes I do, essentially, which is informed by 35 and more years of study of counterinsurgency, which I participated in Vietnam. And there's no question in my mind, there are people in there who understand that there is no success in sight ever for the United States occupiers in Afghanistan. The most we can aspire to is a bloody, escalating stalemate or withdrawal.
Well, finally, Rick, anyone who is hearing this in New York or in Los Angeles will have a chance to see the film in a local theater. Where does the documentary go from there, and can listeners do anything to bring it to their town?
They can go to our website, mostdangerousman.org. We literally just finished the film 10 days ago, so we're right now building a campaign to get it out to other theaters, but also get it out to other venues where there might be political discussions, where it could affect public policy. And it will eventually be on television, but that's down the road.
We've been speaking with whistleblower, writer, and activist Daniel Ellsberg and Rick Goldsmith, co-director and co-producer with Judith Ehrlich of the new film, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. Thank you both for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. The show is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.